It's Iowa Week here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Artistic Iowa, our focus this whole week, not only here on River to River, but also on Talk of Iowa. Today, how art intersects life and work in some surprising ways in the economic sector. We want to examine that intersection, the economy and the arts, how the arts can drive economic rejuvenation here in Iowa. Do you remember this campaign from about a decade ago? It was called the Great Places Initiative, unveiled by then-Governor Tom Vilsack in 2005, an attempt to make Iowa the cultural capital of the Midwest, also with that idea of kickstarting the economic sector through creativity. Now, more than a decade out from that, we're taking stock this hour, asking whether this idea, creativity as an economic driver, has taken hold and how it's evolved. Joining us to do that in this first half hour, Amadeo Rossi is with us, one of the originators of Des Moines' cultural scene in this new millennium. He's manager of 8035 Festival, founder of Vaudeville Muse, producer of Nightfall on the River, to name a few. Amadeo Rossi, thanks for coming into our studio.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Pettigo is with us as well, director of the Creative Class Group. That's an organization founded by the world-renowned urbanist Richard Florida. He's also at NYU as director of the Initiative for Creativity and Innovation in Cities and assistant clinical professor for economic development and director of the Creative Class Group, as I just mentioned. Stephen Pettigo, welcome to our program.
Great to be with you.
Stephen, I'm going to have you sit back for a moment and put this in a larger context in a moment, but let's dig down into what's happened in Des Moines and what Amadeo's been involved in. Give us some perspective. Take us back, Amadeo, to the Des Moines area before the Renaissance, let's call it that, before the change in the past 10 or 15 years to Des Moines of 2000 or the 90s. What were the problems our capital faced?
Well, I'd say that in general, you know, the years that I was growing up, and there was a lot of people or young people that would say there's not a lot to do. The place was sleepy, or there weren't a lot of events, and there just wasn't a lot of creative people in general.
Mm-hmm. Describe what the downtown or the East Village or the Court Avenue area before the change took place.
Well, I mean, the East Village was, I would say, somewhat mostly boarded up or, you know, really mixed businesses. You know, I think you had, even in Court Avenue or the rest of downtown, you might have a retail on the first floor, but the upper floors were boarded up. You know, it was somewhat, I'd say, you know, out of transition, you know, from the freeway in the 50s and the changes that happened. Downtown was once, you know, a hub of people living and cultural things happening, and it had become, you know, mostly empty except for some loop scoopers.
Loop scoopers?
Yeah, that's just young people who really have nothing to do, so they drive around and in circles and kind of meet up with each other a little bit.
Okay, good. I've never heard that term before. That's a nice term, loop scoopers. So Amadeo, take us through the changes that took place during your time in Des Moines. What happened first? What did you do?
Well, I mean, I guess from you know, my perspective, just as an individual contributor, I worked a corporate job, and started a bar, The Lift, and eventually the Vaudeville Muse. And both of these were more in kind of creative capacity. The Lift has paintings up. We rotate monthly. And then the Muse started doing some theater and film and music and eventually became a music scene. But I think what you saw is, you know, maybe in the 90s and early 2000s is a lot of people in different creative areas, you know, coming to light and starting to do their own thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And when you were putting these things into the scene, what were the biggest challenges you faced getting these things started?
Well, I'd say, you know, one of probably the biggest challenges is just having people believe that the quality was here to create good things and to, you know, believe in, you know, the art, the music, you know, the other creative capacities could be as good as in other areas. And, you know, it's one of self-belief, really, that something can happen and the quality and the art is there and the individuals to contribute.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people supporting it, too. What sectors, what areas did the support come from to make this all happen?
Well, you know, from an 80-35 perspective, you know, one of our basic arguments was, you know, we started this rebuild of infrastructure. You see the East Village coming on. You see a lot of investment in streets, the MLK project, you know, these sorts of things. But we needed an investment in content. And that's what you see, you know, from music and, you know, from art and other things. And people of the city, I think they started to understand that, in particular, corporate people understood that if we're going to attract people to work in these big buildings, you know, they want a music scene, they want an art scene, they want something also that they can participate in. And, you know, it just kind of went hand in hand. You know, all of a sudden we had lots of things to do, and it was very different.
Mm-hmm. And now you see in recent years Des Moines receiving a lot of applause from nationwide rankings, surveys in terms of livability. Has a very desirable community to come, live, raise a family, have a career. Talk about that. You've received how many accolades?
Well, you know, we keep hearing, you know, a lot of things about the positive things. You know, the general thing is housing is still affordable here. So if you come here, you know, where you might pay $100,000, $150,000 for a house, that's $300,000 or $500,000 in another community. So it becomes more affordable. There's a shorter distance to commute. Here, you know, our average commute is probably about 15 minutes, even to the, you know, to the distant suburbs. So that gives people more time in hand, to participate and, you know, enjoy things that are going on. And we had, you know, great investments in some of the park structures and, you know, just general, our corporate support of, creative things and nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Pettigo, take us. Put this in context of what we've been seeing happening all around the country with the ideas of Richard Florida, best known for his concept of the creative class and the implications for urban regeneration. Does that fit into what you've been seeing all around the country?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you talk about the idea of the rise of the creative class or the idea of attracting or entertaining the creative class, everything that was previously discussed is right in target, right? I mean, the idea that if you want to attract or retain these knowledge-based workers, the 42 million across the country, technology, arts, culture, professional development type skills, education, you have to provide them with great quality of place and great things to do. And so quality of place has started to play a much larger role as we think about economic development today, or particularly economic development and the revitalization of our downtown. So the idea of having great arts galleries, the option of being having restaurants and nightlife and things to do, the emphasis on placemaking, right, being able to create a place where people want to hang out and there's an authenticity to it and an identity to it, has become a real key sort of, you know, thing that people are talking about in terms of urban development. I mean, you know, if I had been teaching economic development classes 5 to 6 years ago, I probably wouldn't have been speaking much about the importance of quality of place in terms of urban development and the reselling of our cities. But today it's a key concept, right? The idea of placemaking, making places have a sense of identity and character and really reflective of the people that live there is crucially important.
What about this creative class, this term that we use there? Tell us more, Stephen, about the creative class. Who belongs to that class?
Creative class is, as I said before, 42 million Americans. I think actually when you look at Iowa, there's about 365,000. I looked at the data right before we jumped on the call today. They have, you know, they sort of have a sense of a set of skills that are very oriented with the service-based economy or the knowledge-based economy, which we are in toward today. So they're technologists, right? They're entrepreneurs. They may be scientists. They're folks that have arts and culture. So that's designers, artists, entertainers, everyone that you would generally associate with the idea of a quote-unquote a creative economy. You know, we also like to think about them as being professional service workers too, folks that are maybe attorneys, accountants, people that have professional training or high levels of education. They sort of get paid to think for a living, as we like to say. And then finally, folks that work in education, right? University professors, teachers, librarians, things of that affair, folks that are sort of engaged in the conception of public ideas. So it's a knowledge-based worker. When we look at the average salary of a creative class worker across the country, it's about $92,000. It's quite significant. And really, you know, we think that in the next decade, we'll add another 10 million of these jobs as people become more educated and more skilled in terms of university numbers, educational payment going up, the emphasis on skills, the emphasis of skill acquisition.
Mm-hmm. When that first book came out, Richard Florida's Rise of the Creative Class, I think that was in 2002, followed by other books as well. I wonder how it was seen then, Stephen, if you can comment about that. Was there a skepticism among urban planners that this was the way to go, that this was going to awaken communities in the way it has?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, when you look back 10 years on the rise of the creative class, the reason that I always joke with Richard that the book was a bestseller was for two reasons. He had great critics and he had great champions, right? So I think on the critic side of things, I think people were very skeptical of the idea that quality of place would play a role in economic development, and particularly that it would be quality of place that attracts creative talent and skill and people that have high levels of skills to their communities to sort of change the trajectory of communities. So the skill-based quality of place issue. I think also there was critics regarding the whole idea of tolerance and diversity. I think if you go back and remember in the rise of the creative class, Richard wrote a lot about the idea of gay and lesbian index or the bohemian index. These were just sort of crude metrics that looked at the idea of social cohesion and tolerance in our communities. But, you know, I think people were very critical about the idea, does tolerance and diversity play a role? And in fact, I remember one of the most interesting articles or the critiques of this was that Richard Florida was believing that gays and bohemians were going to change the future of our communities. Fast forward 10 years now, he may have been sort of right, right? The idea, not sort of tongue-in-cheek, but the idea that people, climate, quality of place, everything that the previous guest talked about plays a role, right? We want to live in places that we can be ourselves and that have these great things to do. So those were the critics. I think the champions, though, of Richard's work, which I think became a real force behind the rise of the creative class, were many folks that were associated with the artistic community, arts and culture organizations, performing arts organizations, artists, et cetera, who really saw the value of arts and culture in our communities, not just as an idea of being things that we like to do, but they can sort of be an economic driver, the right that we can create interesting design businesses or arts and arts types oriented enterprises that can really be drivers of economic growth going forward. So it was both the critics, I think, and as well as the champions. I think if we fast forward 10 years into where we are sort of now, I think one of the issues perhaps when the rise of the creative class came out that we probably didn't spend enough time talking about was what were all the challenges that an approach like this would create for communities, meaning that, as I mentioned before, you have a high, fast-growing, knowledge-based group of workers in your communities. And then you have a very much a class divide, this idea of a service versus a creative sector in terms of economics, but also along many different socioeconomic divides. And that created challenges, I think, for communities that we're still, right, frankly, are just now starting to grapple with.
Mm-hmm. So you have
these challenges.
Yeah, you have just on that point, you have the haves and the have-nots coming up in these communities. How have communities been grappling with that?
Well, you know, it's one of those questions right now, I think, that that communities, economic developers, mayors, people that are in this space are just now sort of – not just now starting anything, but really starting to wrap their hands around, right? And so if we have – you know, in communities like New York or I'm at or San Francisco or Austin or many of these creative cities, maybe even in Des Moines – you have the challenges of gentrification, neighborhoods that are changing over really quickly, and what does that mean for housing displacement? So I think we're having to come back and really address the idea of affordable housing and having and think about our land use planning, the way that we're sort of thinking about how land use and economic development matches up. I think that's one key issue that we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Amadeo, jump in there. Do you see that that problem happening in Des Moines, gentrification and so forth, the haves and the have-nots in this new millennium's city?
Well, I mean, Des Moines really in a boom right now. I believe 23 new apartments coming online by the end of the year.
Or in apartment this, buildings.
Apartments, mm-hmm. You know, in individual living quarters. You know, there is, you know, you see that in the music sector where a venue goes in at a lower price and then, you know, all of a sudden, buildings are redone and noise becomes a problem. And, you know, there's some rubs in that area. But I think in general, you see Des Moines has, you know, reacted to some of these issues, you know, like some of when you start looking at transportation and our DART locally, and then also one-way, two-way streets and slowing things down to make things more of a community. I just got back from Fort Wayne, Indiana, to witness their first music festival of our type. And, you know, every street was one way. And so everybody's barreling in different directions. You know, for a city to live, you need things to slow down and be more walkable and those sorts of things. And I think they're being, you know, addressed. I don't see huge disparities, but, you know, rents could be going up and cost of living is probably going up and cost of housing. And it becomes more difficult for people that don't necessarily earn that can manage those costs.
Amedeo Rossi, when you look back over the 10 years or so that you've been engaged in this, what would you wish you had known at the start that you know now?
Maybe to buy real estate because, you know, it's really gotten in Des Moines, every nook and cranny is being filled and, it's really unbelievable. If you get, there's so much construction going on. So I think that the whole real estate thing would be, you know, just in general, I think that there's been a good marriage of enthusiasm here from young people, from people locating here, from the community, from governmental officials. You know, I think most people get it enough to keep progressing here. And
so this is really a snowball effect, a virtuous circle, the feedback loop. Word gets out, Des Moines is the place to go, more people come, and it becomes even better.
Yeah, and I mean, the jobs have to be here too. So, you know, the economic development people have to do their part. And, you know, all in all, you know, there's been, I think that, but one thing that I believe we are doing is the perception from young people is very different. I think that, you know, people that are just graduating from high school and what have you, you know, from 10 years ago, they're not necessarily going, I'm going to be Minneapolis or Chicago or one of the coasts or what have you. I think they're looking at, boy, I can live earlier here. And you have so many people that did that, maybe more creative people, that have come back to Des Moines and say, hey, I can have a house and family and I can have it all, whereas I can't have it all in New York.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Pedigo, do you see that happening as well? People saying, okay, I can live in a place with a lot of pluses, but not pay those big cosmopolitan rents and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I think you are seeing the growth of many, you know, sort of second and third tier cities, not third tier in terms of second and third tier in terms of quality, but in terms of population. So many of our mid-sized cities across the country are absolutely becoming places to live. Look, I mean, when you look at the creative class here in New York, for instance, which is a great example of someone in a big city that can handle the churn for so long, right? For so long, many creative workers may be willing to, you know, sacrifice housing, sacrifice the commute, sacrifice some of the quality of life issues. And as they get older, maybe as they get family or different phase in their life, they start to look for a different opportunity in terms of quality of place. So many of our smaller cities across the country are starting to play a role here. And this is why I think that you are seeing the boom of places like Des Moines, perhaps like Austin, these Nashville, mid-tier cities that have developed a quote-unquote creative ecosystem that becomes very appealing to the creative class.
Mm-hmm. And Stephen, is this places, do people kind of graduate through these, or do they tend to stay in the urban center they like?
That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things, right, when you talk about millennials versus Generation X versus retirees and boomers, and everyone's talking about the rise and the coming back to the city, is that, frankly, people use metropolitan areas and regions for many different phases of their lives, right? I mean, in terms of, yes, the younger educated millennials who are skilled are perhaps maybe living in the urban core, but as you mentioned, as you get kids or families, you start, maybe you move out to a different area, or as you get older and as you become an empty nester, a lot of times you move back. What's actually very interesting is the two classes of generations that actually share wants and needs in a community are young individuals, millennials, and actually retirees, like looking for very similar types of things in cities: entertainment options, opportunity for walkability, easy access. So it's interesting to see how how people sort of go through life cycles in terms of how they use their cities. An interesting conversation that I was having this morning with someone, we were talking about New York, and particularly if you would have, 15, 20 years ago, people were moving outside of New York because it was too it wasn't great to raise kids, right? So it was not great environments, not schools. But now when you talk about many of our quote-unquote superstar cities, San Francisco, New York, London, et cetera, it is embedded that people are moving outside of the cities, not because of the quality, but because they've become too expensive, right? And so the cost plays a role. And this is where I think that you can places like Des Moines and many of these smaller communities absolutely have a play in terms of quality of place. That said, though, it can't just be a quality of place play, right? It has to be an economic play for as well, right? So there's got to be great opportunities for being able to connect into, if you're a technology worker, into a technology cluster, or if you're a designer, opportunity in a design field. And so, just as, as workers have skills, cities have skills, and I think people start to make those place choices along an array of different attributes, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Pedigo, you're going to stay with us, I hope, to the next half hour. And in the moments we have until we say goodbye to you, Amadeo Rossi, tell us what's in the future for Des Moines as it continues to go through this positive change. Can you clue us in on some of the next big things on the horizon developing?
Well, I would say the social club that came online in Des Moines is doing a lot of good things in individual areas. They have a theater. They have a lot of individual creativity going on. What I think the next place is maybe in the music community and some of these other communities, the artistic communities. I would say some of these people are going to start making a name for themselves, and that name, becoming famous, will tie back to Des Moines and bring more creative people here as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you have names that already are potentials in that pool?
Well, I mean, one person that's doing great in music, we don't have a lot of people that have made it. We, of course, have the number three metal act in the world with Slipknot, but Max Jury is a name of a person who sold his songs to a publisher. They took him on as a client. He's selling a lot in Europe and just released his first full length. He's a type of person that may do well. And, there are others that I think we're going to see a rise of creativity in Des Moines that's going to make a national name for us for those reasons.
We sure hope so. Amadeo Rossi, thank you for stepping into our studio. Amadeo Rossi, one of the originators of Des Moines' cultural scene here in the new millennium. Stephen Pedigo, please stay with us, director of the creative class, also on the faculty at NYU. When we come back, I'll talk with Zach Mannheimer, Iowa's Business Growth's Vice President of Creative Placemaking. We'll talk about whether these ideas translate also to smaller towns across Iowa. When we return, Iowa Week, as we explore the creative class. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. It's Iowa Week here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our overall focus this week on both talk shows, Artistic Iowa, different intersections of art and life here in Iowa. And this hour, how the economy and the arts intersect, how the arts can drive economic rejuvenation. And we're recalling how in 2005, then-Governor Tom Vilsack unveiled his Great Places Initiative, an attempt to make Iowa the cultural capital of the Midwest, and with the intention of kickstarting the economic sector here through creativity. Now, more than a decade out, we're examining how that proposal, that proposition, has worked out. Joining me now, Zach Mannheimer is Iowa Business Growth's Vice President of Creative Placemaking. We're also proud to say that he's an Iowa Public Radio Board of Directors member. Zach Mannheimer, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
I just have to read this quote from Kyle Munson of the Register about you. I love it so much, and it describes what you're about in this capacity. The arts and cultural evangelist from New York who nearly a decade ago scoured the nation for up-and-coming cities and chose Des Moines as his new entrepreneurial playground. The words of Kyle Munson to describe you, Zach Mannheimer. Let's start with your work in the state capitol. The centerpiece of it, the Des Moines Social Club. Tell us about it, especially for those who live outside Des Moines and who have never been there.
Sure. Well, the social club came about. I moved here in 2007, and then a few other friends of mine, Matt McIver and Julie Betts, moved to Des Moines a year later, also from New York. And together, us and many other people started the Des Moines Social Club. The goal was, how do you create a space for local artists to create and present their work? And that's where we started. And that's the work that many of us did back in New York. But the goal changed dramatically. And we really began to realize how much the arts and culture can really drive the economy and how the two work together. And so today, the Social Club has three missions, in my opinion. It's, of course, to create and present local work. And they work with well over 1,000 local artists every year. There's, I think, over 300,000 people that come in there every year. And they produce well over 800 different events in every single artistic medium, everything from music and live theater to poetry to culinary. There's an aerial arts room, culinary school, so many different things there. Secondly, they work with local businesses on the retention and recruitment of young people to Central Iowa. And that's the key in terms of economic development, is that many young people, when they're thinking about relocating to a smaller community from some of the larger cities in our country, they want to see that we have the amenities that they're looking for. And often these things are live music venues and great restaurants and innovative entrepreneurial concepts and bars and coffee shops and all the things that many places take for granted. And Des Moines had some of that 10 years ago, I would say. But today is swimming in it. Mm-hmm. And it's a big reason why there's been a boom here, not just the Social Club, of course, but so many other things, the 8035 Music Festival, the expansion of the East Village, the culinary scene here, all of those together working hand in hand with the corporate community and the Des Moines Partnership really is what built downtown Des Moines, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And to go back to sort of the overall, the umbrella idea here is, this is really a generational change, isn't it, Zach? Because we go back to the idea a generation or two ago. I remember, you know, moving from Nebraska to Iowa, my parents, five children, moving around, and you thought, the common thought was, well, you move to where the job is.
Yes.
And then second place is, well, we hope it's a nice community, right?
Right. It's like, oh, well, I hope. It's like, will I meet somebody? Will I meet a spouse? I hope so. Who knows?
Right.
Yeah, today it's the opposite. Young people don't move based on jobs anymore. They move based on culture. Mm-hmm. And that's been proven 1,000 different ways. And if you track net migration from the coast right now, I mean, this is what's happening right now. If you're in your late 20s or your early 30s and you're a creative in any sense of the word, and I mean creative in that you're either an artist or an entrepreneur, or in many cases, both. And you haven't, quote unquote, made it on the coast, meaning you're not a millionaire yet. Those areas are oversaturated and you can't afford to live there. And those folks are looking to leave. And they are leaving in droves. But they're not coming to Iowa. They're going everywhere around us. They're going to Minneapolis and Kansas City and Nashville and Austin and Denver. And over the next 10 years or so, those cities are going to become oversaturated. You could argue that many of them already are. And my theory is that over the next 10 to 15 years from now, cities like Des Moines and Omaha and Boise and Columbus and Albuquerque and Tulsa, those are the cities that are going to experience major growth. And we're already seeing it here. But the challenge then becomes, how do you sustain that? And when you think about rural areas around our state and the challenges that so many smaller communities have faced, it's the exact same thing that's happening in those towns that happened in Des Moines over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And they have a major workforce development issue, and they have issues with housing stock. And a lot of it hinges upon the fact that they don't have young people either staying there or coming there.
So let's focus on some of the handful of cities that you've looked at in Iowa, Fort Dodge, Algona, Council Bluffs, Oakland, Earlham, and Walnut. I didn't know this was actually a town. It's on I-80 in western Iowa, famous for its antique shops. That will clue many people in. Oh, yes, I've actually been there. I didn't know I was
right
there. It, like many rural towns, it's experienced decades of social and economic decline. So how do you transfer that magic that has been incorporated in Des Moines to a more rural setting, a small town?
Well, it starts with the people there. I mean, I wouldn't even say that we're transferring any magic. I think that we're inspiring it. And I think that there are many, many great ideas and great leaders in all of these communities. But they've been challenged by hard economic times and a brain drain that we saw here in Des Moines, and that's changing now. That has been happening over the last 40 to 50 years in these communities. A long time ago, there was a big move out from rural areas to urban, and that's been happening and still is happening. But I believe over the next 50 years, it's going to begin shifting in the other direction. And so are these communities going to be ready over the next 20 years when the wave hits of young people looking for smaller communities to live in because they got priced out of the bigger ones? Will they have the amenities the young people are looking for? So you take a place like Walnut. Walnut's done very well, changing their economic landscape by really going all in on the antiquing industry. I mean, this is a small community. There's less than 1,500 people there. But they've got great location. They're roughly an hour between Des Moines and Omaha, right off Interstate 80. They've got a beautiful little downtown. And one of their issues is, the one that I'm hopefully going to be working on, is they have an old school building that recently became vacant because of consolidation, because of population loss. And I bet you can say the same story in 500 other towns across the state. And this is a big problem in a place like Iowa. We have almost 1,000 empty school buildings all over the state that are just sitting there, dotting the landscape and rotting away. And of those 1,000, 57 of them currently are owned by the school districts but are not in use, and therefore are a major drain upon the dollars that those school districts have to use. So how do we remake these buildings, and what can they become? And that's part of our focus.
Now, it's turned out so well for Des Moines, your work there, rejuvenating the city in so many different ways through creativity. And now there's the other places in the state are placing their trust in you to reawaken these other communities. How does that feel, Zach, to have that put on your shoulders? People are counting on you. They love their communities, and they want them to come alive again.
Well, I love their communities, too, and it's a thrilling and scary feeling. You know, you take a place like Fort Dodge, and Fort Dodge is a wonderful town. It's thriving. It's done very well over the last 10 years comparatively to other towns of its size, but it still has major issues. And one of the big issues that it had was this gigantic 260,000 square foot building, the Warden Hotel, right in the middle of downtown Fort Dodge. And it's been vacant for over 25 years. And so an entire generation of young people grew up in Fort Dodge and drove past this thing every day. And it was just this perfect example of what's wrong with the community, that nothing was done with this building. And now city leadership there is being very proactive and aggressive and how to change it. And I've done a significant amount of work on that building, and hopefully we'll be turning that into something great. Then you have a place like Algona. Algona is really an outlier to me in terms of some of the communities I've visited. Algona is about 6,000 people on the county seat of Kossuth County, and it's about 2.5 hours from everything. And therefore, it's downtown, all of on State Street there. Every single storefront is full, and most of them are thriving and doing very well. And they've got some really innovative restaurants up there. There's the Perky Parrot and the Chocolate Season, and Emeralds are three amazing restaurants that would do well anywhere. And people are shocked when they go to Algona and see that you can get New York bagels and lox at the Perky Parrot in the morning. I think it's probably the only place in Iowa you can do that. And in my opinion, the best chocolates in the state are made in Algona at the Chocolate Season. And so they've done well, but they have some significant issues. And you look at the job scenario there. You've got Pharmacist Mutual Company is headquartered there. Snap-on has a major presence. Pioneer, John Deere, Hormel, these major, major companies are based there and employ a lot of people. But they have six-figure salaries that they have trouble giving away. And part of the reason is they have a very big housing stock issue. Most young people don't want to buy homes. They want a really nice modern rental unit, and those don't exist in Algona. And so that's part of the issue. Now there's some being built currently. The other part of it is they're lacking some of the amenities that young people want. And these are not, you know, it's not rocket science to figure out what these things are. And so what I do is I do what I call visioning sessions with the community. I meet with as many community members as I can. And we straight up asked them, what is needed here and what do you want here? And there's a very fine line between need and want. And then we take all that data and crunch it and we determine what can work here financially? What's realistic? And, you know, many of the ideas are just not realistic, but some of them are. And then we begin figuring out the plans of how those things are going to work and how do they take shape and who are the city leaders that are going to run them and be responsible for them.
Zach Manheimer, thanks so much. Iowa Business Growth's Vice President of Creative Placemaking. Thanks so much, Zach.
Thank you, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
It's Iowa Week here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, looking at the rise of the creative class here in Iowa. Going back to our guest from the first half hour, Stephen Pettigo is still with us, the director of the creative class group, also on the faculty at NYU. Stephen, in listening to that conversation with Zach Manheimer, I'd like you to comment on this challenge of bringing some of the lessons learned from the past 10 years or so about the creative class and into rejuvenating some of our smaller cities and towns.
You know, when you think about smaller cities, right, this idea of the creative economy and the idea of quality of place actually becomes really important to them. And in fact, if you think for our smaller communities, it actually starts to play for them into being a sort of a competitive advantage, particularly in terms of attracting and retaining talent to their community. So I think, you know, the previous guest who talked about the idea of the revitalization of even those smaller communities in terms of their downtown core, really wanting to emphasize their authenticity, their identity, who they are, is really, really critical, I think, to the revitalization of these towns. These towns are not going to be production-based towns. They're not going to be agricultural-based towns, continue to be strongholds of just solely agricultural-based economies. They're going to have to participate in this knowledge-based economy. So the idea of trying to attract and retain these creative workers to these places will be key. In addition to that, I think it's also important to think about how these communities are unique and authentic to their history and who they are and the types of people that live there, that they don't become cookie cutter, right?
Right. Like we had the example of Walnut, Iowa, where we have a great antiques tradition, right?
Yeah, absolutely, right? Cities and communities start to become an identity and a character of their own, right? Starting to develop a personality in a sense, right? And so I think understanding who you are and what you are and what your history is and what that sort of directs the future becomes really important.
Okay, Stephen Pettigo, just a few minutes left, but I wanted to also sneak in here at the tail end of this conversation. Matthew Moore is with us. He's on the faculty at the University of Arkansas. Matthew Moore, welcome to the program. You studied creative capital as a PhD candidate at Iowa State University, and you looked into what you thought were sort of downsides to this creative class. Is that right?
Yes. Thanks for having me. When I was at Iowa State, I became interested in creative class and what are some problems we might encounter if we follow that model of economic development.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find? What did you look into and what did you find was in fact the truth?
The first thing we found was, or that I found was, that the creative class is segregating itself. So as was mentioned earlier in the program, with the average pay of $92,000 for a creative class worker. So creative class workers are moving to cities and moving to areas, let's say, within Des Moines, but they're segregating themselves because they make a significantly larger income than non-creative workers. So that's going to lead to not only segregated cities such as Des Moines, but we can end up with situations where you have segregated regions where you have areas of the country that are very wealthy, cities like Seattle, San Francisco, New York, and so on. And then you have cities that, such as St. Louis and Memphis, where they're not attracting the creative workers. So we're ending up with a segregated kind of mm-hmm. region or city.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the have and have nots. Stephen Pettigo, comment on that. Is that what you're finding too? And how do you cope with that? How do you grapple?
Well, I think that's not an easy question to grapple with. It's really up to the politicians and the policymakers in that area to realize what's happening and put in place structures that might be able to prevent this from occurring. So in the East Village, for instance, maybe having some sort of rent control to make sure that non-creative workers aren't being pushed out of the East Village in Des Moines when all the creative workers start moving to that area. So it's not an easy question, and as Stephen mentioned, it's something that cities and states are going to have to grapple with.
Mm-hmm. Matthew, give us another aspect of what you looked into in your the PhD.
I also looked at the creative exposure. So would non-creative workers be exposed to the creativity of creative workers? And sometimes this has been called knowledge spillover. So would the creativity spill into the non-creative workers? And I found that it really doesn't. I didn't find any significant finding there. The creative workers, again, because they are segregating themselves, are isolating their creativity, isolating their knowledge within cities, within counties, within states. So again, just as before, policymakers.
How did you investigate whether they were isolating their creativity? It seems like if you're in the same community, there's a natural spillover. You come into contact with each other somehow, right?
Yeah, of course you come into contact with each other if you go to an art museum and that sort of thing. But if you're living in an area where all the creative workers are living in one neighborhood in Des Moines and the non-creative are living in another neighborhood in Des Moines, the school system, for instance, is going to be segregated along these creative lines, much like we've seen in the past with other areas of segregation. So while they might live in the same community, they're not necessarily talking to each other. They're not necessarily living together. And so that's what we're really getting at with the creative exposure, that creative class workers aren't necessarily making the non-creative class workers better off, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Pettigo, as we wind up this conversation, yeah. We have just a couple minutes left. Perhaps you'd like to comment on something Matthew had to say?
Yeah, I think Matt's right. I mean, one of the externalities or challenges that a sort of creative class model creates is the idea of economic segregation, right? And we see this in all of our communities. In fact, if we were to take a map of all major metropolitan areas and classify where people live in particular in city by city block, you would notice that we start to see some class divides. And to his point, right, I think one of the things that policymakers and economic development officials and land use planners have to think about is how do you build more affordable housing? But really, how do we ensure that our communities remain inclusive? To that end, one of the things that we haven't talked about over the hour, and I think is really important just to sort of end on this note, is we talk about the spillover effects of the creative economy into the service and production-based sectors. One of the things I think we have to realize is, yes, we're moving to a knowledge-based economy, which means if we want more people to participate, we're going to have to rethink about our workforce development programs. We're going to have to rethink about how we develop on-ramp and training programs, and that starts everything from offering new types of programs in our high schools to our community colleges to really short training programs. So really reevaluating the way that we think about how individuals grab their skills or gain skills to actively participate. And that to me is probably an even larger question and more maybe even just as an important piece as it is talking about some of the sort of the safety nets, right? Thinking about how we on-ramp people, more individuals into this creative and knowledge-based economy, right?
Mm-hmm. Stephen, before you go, what about this idea that Zach Manheimer posited there that as these first-tier cities, first tier in terms of population, become saturated, we have another tier of cities, Des Moines, for example, and then smaller cities. Does it fill up that way? Is that the way you see sort of the hierarchy going? And these smaller cities have to be ready for the creative class to overflow into them?
Well, I don't necessarily think it has to be by population, right? I think that's a fault. I think that's not the right way maybe to think about it. But it is about thinking about if you are a Des Moines or a Nashville or second tier, or whatever the size city is, really understanding what your economic development drivers, what your clusters, what your industries are, and how they sort of align with this idea of the creative economy, right? So that, I think that's really key. And if you have these ideas, if you have these economic drivers that line up with the knowledge-based economy, it allows you to be more creative. It allows you to be more competitive within this sort of knowledge or creative economy, right? So, you know, if you think about your economic development sort of strengths in the city and what your industries are, and you think of it as a portfolio, right? One of the things that you want to be sure if you're the city officials or the mayors or the practitioners in the space, that you're thinking about how do the industries sort of compete today and how do they compete tomorrow, because that's what's going to be attractive to the creative workers. You know, your previous guest had mentioned that creative that workers move for culture, and that's absolutely right. but they also move for market opportunity as well. And so making sure that you not only provide the culture, but also the market opportunity that sort of that it lays that foundation becomes really, really important.
Okay, Stephen Pettigo, director of the Creative Class Group, also at New York University, director of the Initiative for Creativity and Innovation in Cities, and assistant clinical professor for economic development, director of the Creative Class Group, as I mentioned there. Thank you very much, Stephen, for joining us this hour.
It's great to join you.
And Matthew Moore, thank you for joining us on the faculty at the University of Arkansas, for telling us a little bit about what you explored as a PhD candidate at Iowa State University. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, what does architecture in your community have to say about where you live? As we continue with Iowa Week, a look at architecture and how it's changed over the past few decades. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Help from John Pemble today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.